Well, we've got one of those infamous special two-for-one deals for you tonight. We've got phone calls with Dr. Ramon Lopez this hour. Next hour, we talk about evil on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Do you think when they developed electricity, Ramon, that they knew that the sun could play havoc with the possibilities?
They had no idea.
No, they didn't know. They didn't know at all. Poor Tesla. I wonder if he knew anything.
He might have had a clue that the sun had some kind of electrical effect, because he was later. But, you know, when people first started setting up telegraph wires and they started having weird things happen when there would be aurora, these magnetic storms, it was a big surprise.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Troy in Norfolk, Virginia. Hey, Troy, welcome to the program. Hi.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. How you doing?
Hey, Troy, thanks for calling.
I was just wondering, Is the government prepared for like this electrical problem nationwide if it happened, like, say, in the wintertime? You know, because they were...
Absolutely not. If something happens in the wintertime and we get the hit and the grid goes down, there's nothing we can do about it. The power system goes and people will freeze. I mean, those are the tragedies, Ramon.
That's right. And your caller points out something very important. You know, you can have a confluence of disasters. I mean, we've had massive storms that really put the Northeast into a big, deep freeze. What if you had a big magnetic storm at the same time that knocked out the power grid? Boy, now you've got a serious problem. Bad enough just with a major winter storm, but if you add the loss of electrical power to that, now you've got a world-class disaster.
No, you sure do. You sure do. You know, you talked about how this satellite is about 1 million miles from the planet. And it's, you know, I guess it's between the sun and the earth, obviously.
Right.
Once it gets hit, if it gets hit with one of these, it's going to wipe it out very quickly, right?
No, not necessarily. Again, you know, the amount of energy in a single spot is not so much. Now, what does happen, what has happened in the past, is that the instruments can become temporarily overwhelmed. And then they'll basically just shut down. So you lose detailed information. But those instruments will eventually recover.
Will they fry?
No, they don't necessarily fry. It's just they're saturated. You know, it's like a Geiger counter, right? A Geiger counter goes click, click, click. You know, if there's each click is indicating some radioactive particle has hit the Geiger counter. But if the Geiger counter has got too much radiation hitting it, you'll hear click, 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 go really high, and then all of a sudden just cut off because the thing is saturated. And if you take it away from the radiation, it eventually recovers and can be used again. Same things happen with other scientific instruments. If they can just become saturated, and then they don't provide you useful information.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The spacecraft, like ACE, has been hit by many, many big coronal mass ejections, and it's still there working modules.
Did you ever see the movie Knowing with Nicolas Cage?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, that you have to see because it has to do with the sun. And we'll wait until next time you're on. I want to get your perspective on it. You like the movie, but it was scary.
Okay, well, hopefully it's on Netflix.
Yeah, you'll probably be able to find it. Well, you know what? I'm not happy with Netflix. Now, they're probably going nuts hearing me say that, but I can't find a lot of current movies on that thing. Can you?
Yeah, that is a problem. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I thought it was me, or maybe I was being cheap or something. No, I can't find it. Let's go to Wichita Falls, Texas. Chad, you're with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Chad.
Hey, George. Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, Professor, I have heard the claim that the largest explosion in the universe is a supernova explosion that results in a gamma ray burster making a black hole. And I was wondering, what if one of those went off with like 10 light years from Earth? What would that mean for us?
Oh, boy, if a gamma ray burster went off 10 light years from Earth, and now the bursters produce beams of gamma rays come out of the north and south poles of the magnetic field. If we were in the path of one of those beams that's only 10 light years away, we'd be surprised. I mean, there'd be a planetary extinction level event. These gamma ray bursters, as you point out, are the most energetic explosions that we know of in the universe. But fortunately, they all happen very, very far away. That's how we know they have to be really energetic, because we see them, and there's, we see them with significant energy here at Earth, but they're so far away, you know, that close up, boy, they must be really screaming. So, but there aren't any in our galaxy that we know of. So that's a good thing. There are smaller versions of that. There are highly magnetized neutron stars called magnetons. They've got huge magnetic fields, much more intense than normal neutron stars. And these things occasionally produce bursts of radiation, including gamma rays. And there was a case of a magnetar that went off in our galaxy, and the gamma rays from that did hit Earth. This was, it was within the past 10 years, I believe. I'd have to look it up to find the exact details. But that gamma ray impact actually ionized a significant amount of atmosphere on the night side of the Earth, enough to cause a lot of radio disruption and to bring the ionization levels almost to the level of the day side that's being, you know, ionized by solar radiation. And to my knowledge, it's the only case of a space weather kind of an event, you know, something that could affect our technology here on Earth, that was produced by another star. All other space weather is produced by our own star.
The solar system. Some say it's heating up. Would you agree?
What do you mean by heating up? I mean,
the other planets are getting hot too.
Oh, are you talking about things like climate change?
Yeah.
And I've seen some arguments that other planets are showing some atmospheric warming. I'm not sure what to make about that. But that's a really hard measurement to make. So it's not really my area. So I'm not sure that I would be able to.
Okay. In terms of the sun, Dr. Lopez, is it changing? Is there anything unusual happening with it? Other than its normal cycles.
The cycle got really weak, and that's why I think that we're going into at least the Dalton or maybe even the Maunder minimum. We've been observing stars that are like our sun, about the same mass and luminosity.
Okay, I'm going to need you to speak up as loudly as you can.
Okay,
I'm losing
you. We've been observing lots of other stars that are about the same size, and the same mass and luminosity as our sun, and you can remotely observe their magnetic activity cycle by looking at spectrum of the light that they produce. And other stars behave like our sun. They've got some kind of magnetic activity cycle that goes from 7 to 14 years. But sometimes stars will turn on their magnetic activity cycle, and sometimes it looks like they're turning off. And that seems to be what happened to our sun in the 1600s during the Maunder minimum, that there were almost no sunspots and very low magnetic activity. And right now we may be heading into that kind of an event. Or it could be a weaker kind of minimum, like what we saw in the 1800s, called a Dalton minimum. But even if the sun's magnetic activity gets weak for two or three cycles, it will come roaring back. I mean, this is the way that stars behave. We don't exactly know why they do this, but they go through long minimums, and then they go through big maximums. And, space weather will always be with us, one way or another.
Sure.
And even during periods of very low magnetic activity, you still have got space weather, because you've got some streams from the solar wind that are moving faster than others, and then the fast streams, they can cause small magnetic storms. And actually, fast solar wind, when it comes blowing past the Earth's magnetic field, it produces high-energy electrons in the orbit of communication satellites. How exactly that happens, still a lot of debate, but we know that it does happen. And these high-energy electrons can damage our spacecraft if they remain at high levels for a long time.
Okay, let's go to San Francisco. John's with us west of the Rockies. Hi, John.
Hi, man. I wanted to tell you something. First of all, I love your show.
Well, thank you, John.
I've been listening to you for over 10, 12 years now. I've been listening since, Art. And you're right. Our planet is getting back. That's evil. That's what I believe. Maya is really our planet, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. Ramon, there's a theory, it's called the Gaia theory, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that the planet is a living organism all by itself, and that it corrects itself on its own. Interesting theory, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the argument is that Earth is a self-regulating system, and that if something moves too much out of equilibrium in one area, then there are mechanisms in the whole Earth system, which is the planet, the biosphere, everything, that will push Earth back towards its equilibrium. And a very interesting idea, and there's a lot of merit to it.
On a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put our prediction level right now in terms of our ability to do what you'd like it to do?
For space weather?
Yeah.
I'd put it about a 3.
Really? That low?
Yeah. Lots more work could be done. Absolutely. But, hey, it used to be a 1.
Well, that's
right?
True. What will get it up? What'll get it up to a 7 or 8?
Another decade of research. You know, you look at weather prediction. When I was a kid growing up, we used to joke about the weather predictions, about how bad they were, right? And nowadays, weather prediction is actually really, really good. And the same thing will happen in the space weather. You know, you give it a decade or two, and our prediction ability is going to increase markedly.
I remember the days I was working at television stations when I was 19 years old, and the weather forecaster at the time, whether he's a meteorologist or just, you know, a pretty good talent, you know, they would try to predict the weather, or they'd get it from the National Weather Service with the forecast. And you're right, the technology has helped, too, dramatically over the years. But weather forecasting has changed dramatically since the computers and Doppler radar and everything else, hasn't it?
That's right. And it's all that computer modeling that, you know, like you go to the Hurricane Prediction Center and you can get really good information about where these hurricanes are going and the probabilities and the wind speeds. That's all from computer simulations and modeling that has been benchmarked against reality over the years as the models keep on getting better and better. We're doing the same thing with space weather models. And that's actually the actual science that I do. I work with these computer simulation models. I'm part of a team of people that we compare the simulation to real events and try to understand where can we do a good job predicting, where do we still need more work, what's the actual physics that needs to be understood so we can do a better job of predicting real events with these simulation models. And so over time, the models just get better and better.
Let's go to Gary, Lexington, Virginia, east of the Rockies. Hi, Gary. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you doing,
George? Good, Gary. Thank you.
And your guest name is?
It's Dr. Lopez, yeah.
Dr. Lopez. I actually called about gamma ray bursts. You had said earlier that if we got hit by one, the magnetic field would protect us. But then another guest came on and said within 10 light years, and that's kind of, you know, silly because our closest star is 27 light years away. But isn't it true that anywhere within our galaxy, if a gamma ray burst went off and we were in the line of fire, it would pretty much fry the Earth?
It would be an extinction level event. That's right. And now gamma rays are not affected by the magnetic field. Our magnetic field gives us no protection against gamma rays. Gamma rays are very high energy light. It's you know, the same light that we use to see that's carried by photons. When the photon has got really, really high energy, we call it a gamma ray. When it's got really, really low energy, we call it a radio wave. So these are just different names we give to electromagnetic radiation. So because gamma rays are light, there's no electric charge, just the photon, our magnetic field provides no protection against that. The only thing you can use to protect yourself against gamma rays is a big shield to block the gamma rays. But that's right. If we had one of these big gamma ray bursters go off in our galaxy and we were in the line of fire, we'd be toast.
Would we have warning on something like that? Oh, I mean, we just
gone.
Dang.
So live your life every day like, hey, it could just
like
be
it's
gone.
Your last one.
Exactly.
Wow. Now, what are the odds?
Pretty small.
Okay.
Vanishingly small. We, as far as we can tell, the conditions for gamma ray bursts.
Are the odds better winning the Powerball?
Oh, far better.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm not banking.
Then I feel safer. Well, let's go to Spring, Texas. Jerry, it's your turn. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning there.
Morning, Jerry.
George, right now I'm here on 740 there at KTRH, sir.
Super.
I want to ask him a couple of questions about this deal there. What about this Earth back in the early early is here where it stopped, and the sun grows up and come back. They say that if it stops like that, well, all the water is going to rush to the center because it's going to be turning fast and then stop and start back the other direction.
Well, and you mean the spinning stopped?
Yeah. It stops so fast, and then it starts up again. Well, causes big tsunamis.
All right, let's find out on that one first. I don't know if the planet's ever stopped like that. Has it, Ramon?
No, it can't. You set something spinning, and it's got a certain angular momentum. You've got to exert a huge torque on it to make it stop, and then you'd have to exert the same amount of torque to spin it up again. There's nothing that can exert that kind of torque on a planet. Even if you had one planet collide into another, you could change the angular momentum somewhat, but it's not going to be a huge change.
So it hasn't stopped, and it's not going to stop.
No. Earth is slowing down. That's because Moon over billions of years has exerted tidal forces on the Earth, and it's stealing a little bit of its Earth's rotational energy. So, like in dinosaur times, the day was I think only like 21 hours instead of 24. So Earth is slowly spinning down as the moon takes that energy and slowly moves out away from the Earth. But those are changes over billions of years. And, there's nothing that we know of that would just make the planet stop turning and then start it up.
Well, that's a good thing. Jerry, you had another question. Go ahead.
George, the other question was about these gamma rays. Is he talking about pulsars? Did it shoot out like laser beams?
Yeah, pulsars do that. Pulsars produce gamma rays on occasion, and the exact reason why they do that is a lot of argument. But those gamma rays will be produced along the axis of the magnetic field, like a bar magnet. So they come out of the north and south poles of the pulsar. But most pulsars don't have really huge magnetic fields. There's a certain class of pulsars called magnetars. They've got, magnetic fields 100 or 1,000 times larger than the normal pulsar. And those can produce some pretty big bursts. But the pulsars are always producing some kind of radial beam along that dipole axis. And then as they spin around, if that radial beam happens to cross over us, it's like we see a blip. And then we see it on a regular blip, blip, blip every time it rotates past us and that beam passes over us. It's like a searchlight, that's going around.
Sure.
And that you would just see it every time it passes over you. And that's how they were discovered, is that there was this radial blip at a certain frequency, and it was very, very regular. And the first idea was that it was little green men. Could this be some kind of signal of alien civilization? But then they decided, no, it doesn't look like that. Let's think of natural reasons why this could happen. And that was the discovery of pulsars.
All right, Ramon, we're going to come back and ask you some final questions here as we talk about storms from the sun. By the way, science and science fiction writer Jerry Purnell recommends you also put this book on Kindle. He said he's selling a lot of his work on Kindle these days. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we're going to spend some time talking about evil, why it happens, and how prevalent it may be. When we come back, final phone calls with our guest, Dr. Ramon Lopez, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We'll take your final phone calls now. And also, Ramon, isn't it, I don't believe in coincidences. With a metaphysical question like this, isn't it amazing that things on this planet all seem to work? The moon is at a certain proximity. The sun is at a certain spot. Everything seems to work. We've got that little, layer to protect from radiation. I mean, it's amazing. However this design was, and who created it, they thought this thing out.
It's the super Goldilocks effect. Not too hot, not too cold, just right.
It is mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah.
How it works. It didn't work for Mars. It didn't work for Venus. But it works for us.
Yep.
Let's go to our wild card line, Steve, Queens, New York. Hey, Steve, go ahead.
My pleasure to talk with you.
Sure thing.
I believe that the sun, the way the sun is acting these days, is having the effect on humans and animals alike in their behavior, dealing with the cosmic and solar effects affecting us all in the way of behavior we're having. But anyway, my question to the doctor is, contrary to what he's saying, I believe that there's a star out there that will have a rippling effect. Basically, Planet X, I want to get his take on that. Does he see Planet X? What's his opinion on what that planet can do to changing the atmosphere? And I say that the magnetic field is weakening.
Assuming there is a Planet X out there, can another body in the solar system be having any kind of influence on us, Ramon?
No. Even, you know, Jupiter, which is by far the largest planet in the solar system, doesn't have a direct effect on us, like, say, through tides or things like that. The moon, which is much closer, will have much more effect on things like tides, including tides in the atmosphere.
Yeah, I'm losing you again, by the way. So.
Tides in the atmosphere, because there are atmospheric tides as well. Now, what Jupiter has done in the past is it's shielded us against asteroids.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jupiter acts like a vacuum cleaner out there in the outer solar system, and you know, asteroids that, and comets that might have come into the inner part of the solar system get trapped by Jupiter instead and hit Jupiter instead of hitting Earth. And that has protected life on Earth. But there's, you know, as far as additional planets out there, I mean, we demoted Pluto from being a planet.
Yep.
Because, you know, the definition of a planet now is such that Pluto isn't a planet. You got a whole bunch of small icy bodies out there like Sedna and others that are, you know, of Pluto's size, but they're far away. Or they're all in this region called the Oort cloud, and astronomers decided, well, no, these things don't really fit the categorization of planet like the other eight bodies in the inner solar system. So
poor Pluto.
There's no Planet X. There's other stuff out there, sure. Pluto-like objects further out than Pluto that we haven't found yet.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you that. Is there that distinct possibility we might have a incredible discovery one day, and we just have no idea today?
Of a really large object,
yeah,
in the outer solar system? If there was a really large object in the outer solar system, we would have seen it through its gravity.
Even a Mars-sized object?
Mars size, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it depends on how close it is to Pluto, because a Mars-sized object that's not that far from Pluto would have caused changes in Pluto's orbit that we would have seen.
Okay.
And we would know that there's something.
Something's doing it, yeah.
Yeah. And Mars is not so big, you know, so the chances of a large object in the far reaches of the solar system are extremely remote.
Let's go to Sergio in La Puente, California, first-time caller. Hey, Sergio. Hi.
Hi, good evening, guys. How are you doing?
Good, Serge.
Hey, big fan. Actually, I've been listening to you for a whole 10, 11 days. But yeah, and I have a really, really great story because I actually read Walter Crittenden's book, who was on your show.
Sure, just a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
And that book on The Lost Star, speaking about the binary system,
mm-hmm.
We may not have effects from other planets, but what he put in that book and what he represented, it totally made complete sense. It explained a lot. It explained a lot about the Bible, explained a lot about what we're going through and the stages of enlightenment that man goes through. Look at what's going on right now. We're having an explosion of knowledge right now about us, about our bodies, about the universe, about the solar system. And it's a part of enlightenment. And I'm going to go to the CPAC convention in October and learn what's my first time going there. And I wanted to know, you know, Dr. Lopez, I know you had mentioned there's nothing out there, but what do you think about the binary system theory?
Well, I don't know what the binary system theory is. I will tell you that most stars come as binary stars. There's two stars. Our sun is not like that. Our sun does not have another star-sized companion that they're in orbit around each other.
If we had a dark star, would we still find it by now?
Yeah, if there was a stellar mass object out there, we would have seen it, because you don't see it directly. You see the gravitational effect that it has on other objects. In fact, that's how we discovered, I think it was Neptune.
either Neptune or Uranus, whichever. There was one that was discovered that way, that we looked and we could see that there were motions that were unexplained, and it had to be due to the pull of another large object out there, and then you work backwards and go and look, and lo and behold, there it is. So if there was another stellar-sized object, even at really far distance from the sun, but close enough that you could consider them a binary star system, we would have seen the evidence by now.
Interesting. Text message in from Jim in Alaska. How did our astronauts that went to the moon go through the Van Allen belt and not get hurt, the radiation belt?
They weren't there that long.
Okay.
If you stay in the radiation belt for a long time,
you're going to get it.
Yeah, eventually, yeah. I mean, that's why we don't fly spacecraft in the Van Allen radiation belt in those orbits. Fortunately, you know, that's not an important orbit. It's not like the orbit of communication satellites, which are further out than the Van Allen radiation belt. But, if you stay there a long time, you're going to get a healthy dose.
I wonder if they still medically monitor the older astronauts now.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
The Edgar Mitchell. I got to ask Ed Mitchell. He's a dear friend of ours. I got to ask him if they still call him back in every once in a while.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they do.
Let's go to Statesville, North Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi, George. First time, long time.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Lopez, are you familiar with Schumann's resonance?
I have heard the term. I don't. Not coming to mind exactly what that is.
What is
it? Basically, it's an average measurement of the noise created by lightning happening all over the planet that's echoing around in the reverberation chamber created between the bottom of the ionosphere and the top of the surface of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And my interest in it is that average occurs right between the brain waves we have during sleeping and waking. My question is, earlier you talked about if I understood it right, but during this magnetic pole flip that's going on, you said it would take a period of time. I've read, and I think you said, that the magnetic field of the planet would go to zero or near zero during that flip. And my question is, one thing I don't quite know is, if the ionosphere were to, say, disappear, I'm assuming Schumann's resonance and the noise it creates would go away. So if that magnetic field collapses, basically, what would happen to the ionosphere? And not just for this, but like for global shortwave communication by us ham radio guys, et cetera.
Well, the ionosphere will still be there. I mean, what makes the ionosphere is light from the sun ionizes gases at high altitudes. So you get this layer of plasma, electrically conducting gas. That's what we call the ionosphere. That's really independent of the Earth's magnetic field, its direction, its strength, all of that stuff. The conductivity of the ionosphere does depend on the Earth's magnetic field for complicated reasons, but the actual presence of a conducting layer there is independent of the fact that the Earth has a magnetic field. It's just produced by sunlight. So as long as we got the sun shining, there'll be an ionosphere.
Could it change the altitude or the thickness of the ionosphere dramatically if the magnetic field collapsed?
No, not really, because what determines the height of the atmosphere is the complex interplay of the recombination of the ionized gas and the production of new ionized gas, plus the fact that as you go up in altitude, the amount of gas gets less and less and less. And so, you know, you can do the calculation of how much sunlight actually gets to certain points and how thick is the atmosphere there. What's the recombination rate, what's the ionization rate? You do all that calculation, and you come out with an ionospheric layer. And you don't need to include anything about the Earth's magnetic field when you do that calculation.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. That shoots my theory down, but back to the drawing board, but thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, George.
Okay, you're welcome, too. Let's go next to Rick in Palmdale, California. Hey, Rick, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Thank you for calling and taking my call.
Sure thing, Rick.
Love your show.
Thank you.
And, I have a question for the guest. What if a solar flare, instead of taking out the Earth, takes out the moon? It skips the Earth and it hits the moon and it fries the moon. What would happen then?
Well, if we had technology on the moon,
then then you could have the impact of the solar of coronal mass ejection on lunar technology. It would be pretty different though, because you know the moon doesn't have a magnetic field of its own. So you know, while the Earth's magnetic field protects us against solar radiation, it's also like a big catcher's mitt. You know, so it catches all the energy and funnels it down into the Earth's atmosphere. You wouldn't have that problem with the moon. And then also the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. So you know, space weather on the moon is mostly an issue of just space radiation. But, you know, the distance from the Earth to the moon is really pretty small compared to the size of these kinds of things. And one of these big clouds was, you know, blasting out from the sun, it's the angle that it's making is a large fraction of the solar system. So anything that hits the moon is pretty much going to hit the Earth and vice versa. You know, the edges of these things are not so thin that the distance between the Earth and the moon is a big factor.
Okay, hope that helps. Jim in Rochester, New York, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hey.
I talked real quick. I talked to a Lakota Indian, and he told me, you know, they're Mother Earth, and Earth lives and everything. And he was saying down in Australia there's a certain bush that the dingoes or a certain one of the animals down there used to feed on, and the population grew of these animals in such a manner that the plants were being devastated, and they actually changed themselves into poison to slow down their extinction from these animals eating them. And I wondered if you've ever heard of that.
I have not. Ramon?
No, I haven't either. But let's imagine you got a population of plants, and a few of them are poisonous. It's not a big group of those. The poisonous ones are the ones that are most likely to survive because they taste bad, so animals will stop eating them. And so the next generation, there's just going to be more of the poisonous plants.
Well, that's true, too. So, Ramon, tell me a little bit more about your work. What do you do now?
Well, most of my my work with space weather involves analyzing the results of these big computer simulations. Like I say, I'm part of a team of people that works with computer simulations of the solar wind interacting with the Earth's magnetic field, and you know, we make comparisons to real events. In fact, we had just a bunch of papers come out on a study of an entire rotation of the sun. So, running the codes with real data from the sun for one entire rotation, 27 days, and making comparisons to observations. In some areas we do well, in other areas not so great, but in one area in particular we know why the computer simulation is giving us something that's different from reality, and we believe we have a way to make the simulation better so that it'll be more accurate. This is just an ongoing work, you know, improving computer simulations. We can turn them over to the National Weather Service, and then they can transition them to operations for space weather prediction.
Okay, next up we go to Tampa Bay, Florida. Hello, John. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask your guest about this dual star theory and a dark star again, because as I understand it, one eon is the amount of time it takes our sun to go around its star, which is a dark star.
Well, again, there's no evidence that anywhere in the neighborhood of the solar system there's another massive body, like a stellar-sized mass. Because if there was, we would see the effect on the motion of the planet. And at this point, there's no evidence. So I would say there's no dark star sitting out there. That, you know, there's no stellar mass object that's nearby our sun. If there is a big object, it's far enough away that the effect on the motions of the planets in the solar system is so small that we haven't detected it.
How long does it take a sunspot to travel around the sun?
Well, the sun rotates with roughly a 27-day period. Different parts of the sun rotate at different speeds. So sunspots, when they pop up, they pretty much stay roughly fixed. So 27 days to come around.
Okay, so it moves along at a pretty good clip on from one edge to the other, doesn't it? Why does it stay so long? Why don't these sunspots dissipate a little quicker?
Well, they do. Over several days, they will dissipate. And actually, they tend to start at the beginning of the solar cycle up at the polar regions, and then they drift down towards the equator, And then when they stop, when they get to the equator and they start vanishing, and then they start appearing at the poles again, that's when you know you've started a new solar cycle.
Hmm. Well, I got to tell you, it is something that one day we're going to wake up and get one of these stories in the reports from someone like you, Ramon, that one of these CMEs, that they're on the way.
Yeah.
and then brace yourselves.
You know what? One thing I worry about long term is if we go through a period of the next few years of relatively quiet solar activity, people are just going to say, oh, this is not a problem. We don't have to worry about this, right? And so companies are not going to engineer to be able to handle more severe effects in our systems. And then one day the sun's going to come roaring back, and then we're going to be in trouble. That's one thing I really do worry about if we have a long solar minimum period, is that people forget and they won't engineer what needs to be engineered.
Let's go to Jack, Santa Barbara, California. Welcome to the program. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yes, I was just wondering, you know, I have this question listening to you. It's very intriguing. Thinking about what the Mayan Indians and this fall and how I've heard different stories about how we're supposed to go through this bump or into a different area. And I was just wondering if maybe you can explain a little bit, you know, you're talking about the weather, where we're going. Are we going into a different place and we could, you can see ahead, or what scientific information could you give me to make me comprehend what they're talking about?
Well, you know, the Mayans had a sophisticated decimal-based calendar. They used base 20. So, you know, they would count up to 20 and then they'd go to the next number. So, you know, a 1-0 for a Mayan would be 20 of whatever is opposed to 10 for us. And what's coming up is just a rollover of their calendar. It's like our year Y2K, right? We went from 1999, we add one more year, then we go to year 2000. Well, that's just our calendar. That's our counting system. They didn't associate any huge significance with this coming rollover any more than we did. People got worried because of computers, right? The Y2K bug. They thought that there might be an issue because of that. But other than that, there wasn't any real issue of going from 1999 to 2000. Because these are, you know, arbitrary calendars that we just use to mark time.
All right, Ramon, we're out of time, but good luck. And do consider putting the Storms from the Sun on Kindle. You might do very well with that. Up next, we talk about evil on Coast to Coast AM.